Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Glories to Srila Prabhupada. Ram Vishnupuraya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimad Bhaktivedanta Swamini Nitinamani. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nivishesha Shunyavari Pashat Chiti Sazarne. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. I'm not sure, but it seems that Bhaktivedanta Purna Maharaj will not be here today. I was just informed this morning that there's some function over at the girls' school, and he and Preeti Vardhan are there. I don't know anything more than that. He might come, but I don't see him. Where's Shisha Prabhu? Shisha, I saw him. Come here.
He often arrives a little bit late. He often arrives a little bit late.
I thought I saw him.
So he's coming.
He disappeared somewhere. Okay. Anyway, I wanted him to see this, but I'll introduce everyone today. We have a special guest at our Bhagavatam class. On my desk here, this is an example of a bichu. Bichu means a centipede. You can't really see very well, but he's about this long and very ugly looking and extremely poisonous. These are the kind of things we have to contend with here when you live out in the forest, Mayapur. Sometimes you find them at night crawling over your body. So this one we brought to hear the Bhagavat Katha before we send him on his way to his next body. Because Bichu is, you know, snakes and scorpions should be killed. That is doing them a great favor. In Bengali language, scorpion is... Oh, hey, Shisha, come here. I'm waiting for you. Yeah. Take a good look. Bichu, just don't open. Just look.
Oh, I see.
Brazilian aquatic centipede. Scorpion in Bengali language is Karkara Bichu. So the root term is Bichu. Karkara means like a crab. You see? And this is the basic Bichu. And this thing is so poisonous that if it bites a child, the child may die. So please do not, if you ever find one of these things, probably in the Grihasthapara there, not so many of them, but out here, we run across them quite a bit. Don't show any sentimental mercy to these creatures. Squash them. I always cut them into four pieces. Okay. But he's going to hear Bhagavatam, so he'll be greatly benefited. So it appears that we have completed our questions. As I remember, the last question was Narada Muni is taking part in Krishna's pastimes and even he becomes a gopi, but still his Ishtadeva is Narayan. Why?
Actually, Maharaj, I think there's one we didn't cover.
One we didn't cover. Do you know where it is?
Yeah. Doyal Gauranga's one.
Doyal Gauranga's?
Same page, first question.
We find that Akrura and Ugrasena had some disagreement. So, can you please explain where in the life of devotees can be that disagreement without offense, and where offense starts? That's a very interesting question. So rasa can be compared to cooking. Lord Krishna is, one of his names is Rasika. That means he is the most expert in combining rasas. The basic dictionary definition of the word rasa is taste. You see? So, when we use the term rasa, we're speaking of transcendental tastes of love of Godhead. Prabhupada took the translation from his spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, mellow. If English is not your first language, then I'll try to explain this word so you have a little more appreciation. Mellow is a kind of taste that develops in a substance, like, let's say, for example, some sort of juice or something like that, that you let sit for a while. I'm not talking about necessarily that it goes alcoholic, but I just mean to say that some things, when you let them sit, you see, isn't it? Like gulab jamun, for example. That's a very good example. Gulab jamun, you prepare gulab jamuns and you put them in their sugar juice. So if you serve them just 10 minutes afterwards, you know, they're not going to be so sweet because they haven't had time to absorb the sweetness. So this is the sense of the word mellow, that after some time of cultivation, then this particular flavor manifests and is prominent. So actually in the development of rasa, it's like that. One is in our spiritual advancement. Who's making this? Please tell them to. Is that Ramvi? Hey Ramvi! Shut up! Anyway. So mellow is something that is cultivated, and sweetness is brought out after a long period of cultivation. So, Rasika, Krishna, that is the name of Krishna, Rasika. He is the most expert in combining rasas, just like in cooking. Now in cooking, you can combine contrary rasas. Like for example, there are preparations that are simultaneously sweet and sour. These are apparently opposites, sweet and sour. But if they're combined tastefully, then the result is delicious. Or as it is said about Srimati Radharani, that on her appearance day, Radhastami, that a preparation which we used to in ISKCON called the Radha Red Chutney, it's a plum chutney, should be served. So this is a dark red chutney, the redness of course coming from the plum, that symbolizes already Srimati Radharani's fiery nature. And Prabhupada said about this preparation that it should be, you should put so much sugar into it and at the same time so much chili that it should be too hot to eat yet too sweet not to eat. And this captures something of the nature of Srimati Radharani. So these are two contradictory qualities, hot and sweet. And yet, Srimati Radharani combines them both in her own person. You see, so this is Rasika. And Krishna's, his Leela, he arranges his lila with his yogamaya potency in order to combine devotees, just like there with Srimati Radharani, the eight principal sakis, the eight principal gopis. You see them on the altar. So they're expansions of Radharani, and each of them are contributing some flavor to the relationship between Shishi Radha and Krishna. Some particular, they have some particular input. Just like, who is the one? Sweet Hands? Is that? Champakalata, yes. So she's very expert in cooking sweets. Misti Hana, I think. That's what they call her. So each one of them is very, very expert in performing certain activities which lend flavor to the nectar, the already ocean of nectar that is being exchanged between the divine couple. So this is the first principle that we need to understand. And in the expression of rasa, you see, it can be, yes, it can be very fiery. In the pastimes of Radha and Krishna, sometimes Srimati Radharani is becoming so angry, so furious with Krishna, because she may feel neglected by him. So she rebukes him in strong language. Sometimes she becomes so angry that Krishna has to worship her lotus feet in order to pacify her. So she is his best devotee, foremost devotee. Actually, she is simply the, in a transcendental sense, the feminine feature of God himself. Radha and Krishna form complete whole. So sometimes, although Krishna is Purusha, and therefore we take it that he is in charge, and Srimati Radharani is the devotee, sometimes Krishna is having to show utter surrender to Radharani in order to pacify her, because she becomes so angry with him. But this is her nature, and Krishna enjoys this. This is the point. Is it enjoyable to Krishna? So your question about where is that line between, if we see disagreement between devotees, where is that line where if it's crossed over it becomes offense? It's a very simple answer. It's the line where Krishna is no longer pleased. And that's the line where our own false ego, is coming up, hamkara, is coming up and becoming the center of our emotional life, or our the reason for why we are saying what we are saying, doing what we are doing in regards to another. You see? Even it can be, we don't have to talk only about disagreement. We can talk about like, for example, in the early on in the fifth canto, we'll read about, whenever we get there, months from now, we'll get to the description of Maharaj Agnidra and the Apsara Purvachitti. So this is within, this is all coming, following as an answer to Parikshit Maharaj's inquiry into the activities of the Manus and the Prajapatis, the Visarga. That means the secondary creation of the Lord. There's the primary creation, Shodashakala, the 16 prime ingredients of the material creation, which emanate from the Lord's own body at the Hiranyagarbha stage of manifestation. That means original ear, eye, nose, tongue, skin for Gyanindriya, original Karmindriya, this is 10. Original Mahabhutas, five gross elements or they're also the objects of these five senses, that's 15, and then the original mind. So these manifest in the Mahatattva, or Hiranyagarbha manifestation. This is in the Chatravyuha, this is Pradyumna. So first there's Vasudev, the purely transcendental Brahma-Bhuta stage. Then Mahavishnu. So this is Yoga Nidra. This is a primordial Tamoguna. All living entities are submerged in total ignorance. So deep ignorance, they're not even aware of their own existence. You see. And this is actually the goal of the Buddhists. Because in 12th canto, Srila Shukadeva Goswami described this experience of Mula Prakriti or Pradhan. And Srila Shukadeva Goswami says this, the experience of Mula Prakriti is the experience of Shunya. Shunya means void. It's not void in the sense of nothing is there, but there's nothing to perceive. There's no awareness, there's nothing to perceive, there's no perception or object of perception. So it is like experiencing void. And then from this then comes Hiranyagarbha. Pradyumna expands from Sankarsana, who is the origin of Mahavishnu. So next is Garbhodakashaya Vishnu and Hiranyagarbha manifestation. So this is in philosophy, this is the realm of ideal forms, you know, in Platonic philosophy. This was the idea that there's a realm of ideal original forms, that a flower of this world is a kind of reflection, a temporary fading reflection of an archetype. That would be a term you find from Jung, Carl Jung. He used this term, archetype. It means the original form. So this is the Hiranyagarbha level, where the Lord manifests the blueprint for the rest of creation, the archetypical. What is the eye? What is the ear? So the Lord manifests this. And then Lord Brahma, who grows from the lotus flower of Garbhodakashaya Vishnu. So he draws the plan for creation from this blueprint that is manifested in the Hiranyagarbha stage, which is svapna, dream. It's the subtle stage of creation, so it's compared to svapna. And the consciousness associated with Mahavishnu before that is sushupti, total unconsciousness, like deep sleep. And then jagrata is when the jiva awakens. After being created, then he awakens, and he's fully, not fully, but he's aware of these 16, shodshakala. He's conscious of them as his body and as the objects of his senses. And this is, behind this is Aniruddha, Paramatma. He's giving this consciousness to the jiva of the creation that is unfolded before in the final stage. This is the gross stage, Vishva. It's called the Vishva stage of creation. So, I don't know how we got off on that path, but anyway, it was interesting, wasn't it? Last thing I remember was is that we were talking about how we don't have to be speaking just about disagreements. We can also speak of, you see, when the ahamkara comes up, either what we've seen in my many years in Krishna consciousness is that between devotees, either you have, yes, fighting because of ahamkara, they disagree because someone thinks what I say is right or I'm better than you, this is their conception. Or they form a nonsense friendship for sense gratification. They become good buddies and, you know, always talking jokes and making sarcastic comments about other devotees together, you see. So Krishna is not the center in either case. The center is my own pleasure. One is even taking pleasure from anger in this ahamkara conception, getting sense gratification from anger, you see, or getting sense gratification from mundane friendship. But either way, it is not pleasing to Krishna. So this is very important to understand, because simply because we may have devotees who are, you know, like cut out dolls, you know, we have some conception of what is good devotee. And so we try to mold the devotees in the bhakti program, like cut out so many, you know, like children, we make these cut out dolls, you know. So that's becomes a conception of a good temple. We have like clones in science fiction, the idea of cloning people. So everyone very well behaved. Yes, Prabhu. Yes, Prabhu. Please, Prabhu. Yes, Prabhu. Pass the salt, Prabhu. And like that, everyone being very pukka in their behavior. But that in itself does not add up to satisfying Krishna. That is simply a mode of behavior. And it could also be for sense gratification. Because in upper class realms of any society, then good decorum is considered important. Etiquette is considered important. That, speech should be nice. Speaking softly, and pleasantly, like that. So the real dividing line, it's not a question of, you know, where does anger go too far, because you can also raise the question of where does niceness go too far on the other side. It's not just a question of that anger. You see, this very question is coming out of some dualistic conception that anger is bad. And to be nice, have a plastic smile on your face, nodding your head and agreeing with everything. You see, being very polite. Oh, that is good. That is ideal. That's what we want. You see, yeah, that's what they want in the church Sunday school. They want to produce all kinds of little children who are. You see, but if that's not pleasing to Krishna, then really, in the ultimate sense, it is no bad. I was having a wonderful talk yesterday with, of course, one of my most beloved godbrothers. Now in ISKCON, he's considered a rather rambunctious type of character by some persons. Rambunctious means rather controversial. So His Holiness Bhakti Vikash Maharaj. But I love him very much. And he speaks very directly and he knows what he's talking about when he speaks. Although it does upset a lot of people. See, because he doesn't really, he's just very direct. So he was speaking about the dire consequences that can come about from this misconception that simply being nice, you see, niceness, decorum, is somehow better or closer to Krishna consciousness or something like that, than just being outspoken, being blunt, not caring for vox populi. You see, people can become very sorely misled by this so-called niceness. Prabhupada used to describe material society as self-congratulation society. You see, that people, on the basis of false ego, they smile, they shake hands. Oh, you're looking so good today. Oh, yes, and you too. Oh, where did you get that shirt from? Where did you buy that shirt? Oh, yes, I bought it in the shop. Oh, it looks very nice. Oh, and your perfume smells so good. Yes. And all of this is going totally in it, you know, deeper and deeper and deeper into illusion. And in the name of niceness, then the most horrible things can come out. The most horrible types of behavior can come out, as we see in the world today. You see, actually, I like to give the example. You see, because nowadays, looking back in history, the National Socialist movement of Germany in the 1920s and 30s, Adolf Hitler's movement, is considered, it's like the archetypical evil movement, you see. The inauspicious, hateful, so very, very bad, the worst thing that ever happened in the last several centuries was Hitler and the Gestapo and the SS and all those bad things they did. But one thing, the Nazi movement began as a youth movement. You see, this is one thing. Now in our world today, anything that stresses youthfulness, you see, youthful good looks, youthful style of dress, youthful music, that's all considered good. So this is how the Nazi movement began, as a youth movement, you see. It was new, it was exciting, it attracted many, 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 many young people who were looking for some meaning in life. And so they all flocked to this movement. And then also it was preaching, they were preaching moral principles. Very strong moral principles. And so they were gaining respectability from that. They were speaking about the ills of capitalism and the danger of communism. And all these things were considered very good. In fact, in the 1930s, before it became apparent that Hitler was, a very greedy and bloodthirsty type of person who wanted to take over the world. But when he was just organizing Germany, because Germany almost, the nation almost toppled into communism in the 1920s. It almost, after the Soviet Union became communist, Russian communists, Lenin and Stalin, they all had their sights on Germany. Why? Because the communist philosophy came from Germany, Marx and Engels. And they just thought, naturally, this should be the next country. Lenin used to give lectures in German, you see, as well as Russian. Because it was the language of communism, Das Kapital, written by Karl Marx. So Hitler came along and he saved Germany from communism. He organized the government in a way that stopped communism in its tracks. And Winston Churchill, as now we look back and we think of Winston Churchill, great hero, him and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they stopped the advance of the German armies and all of that, D-Day and all of that, blah, blah, blah. But Winston Churchill back then, he made a statement in the House of Parliament, "Thank God for a man like Adolf Hitler." It's on record. "Thank God for a man like Adolf Hitler, that a man like Adolf Hitler has come to power in Germany." So you see, in the beginning, the Nazi movement looked very good. It was a youth movement, it captured the imagination of the young people, and at the same time, it was preaching very strong moral principles. It was giving them discipline, giving them a purpose. Germany's economy was all in shreds and tatters because of the Depression. So Adolf Hitler started this, Arbeit durch Freude movement, work through joy, organizing these work brigades. They would hold the shovel like rifles and march down the streets and do construction work, build houses for the people. The Volkswagen car, this came out of the Nazi period. The people's wagon, that's what it means, the people's car. Volkswagen. Now, Volks, the word Volk in the German language under the Nazi time had a very, very, very sinister meaning to it. Das Volk, the Aryan people as opposed to the rest of the people who ended up in gas chambers. But this is the origin of that nice little looking little car, you know, the cute little Volkswagen. It also came out of the Nazi period. You see? And after the, you know, after the Second World War, the Germans, the next German government, they made millions and millions of dollars with this Volkswagen that was developed in Hitler's time, selling it all over the world. They still make them in Mexico, the original. And now there's a new version of it, which is selling very well. So, you know, just as much as the swastika tipped on the side, that's very inauspicious. The Vedic swastika is flat like this. But when you turn it like that, then it becomes an inauspicious symbol. So, as much as that is a symbol of Nazism, so is the Volkswagen. You see? So just because something looks nice, you see, and there's good behavior and all of that, does not at all mean that it's good, that the end result is going to be favorable. So we shouldn't fall into this dualism, that thinking that relationships should between devotees should all be, you know, just prescribed smiles and nodding of heads. This is Hinduism, you know, pranam ko, behaving very nicely. But in bhakti, there is rasa. And rasa means sometimes things get very hot, even in Krishna's service. Krishna's personal service. Like there is this hot relationship between Srimati Radharani and another gopi whom we shall not mention, who has her own yuta, and they compete for Krishna's affections. Now Krishna is enjoying this again. Krishna's in the middle. He's got the gopis, their beauty is, you see, it says the moon falls down at the feet of Radharani. No heavenly apsara, none of them. They're all defeated by the beauty of the gopis. You read that in the 11th chapter, that the wives of Lord Krishna at Dwarka, who are actually expansions of the gopis, are so beautiful that they could even cause Lord Shiva to fall down. And he is Dhira. He is a perfect example of yogi who is so absorbed in meditation that even when Parvati came to him, he ignored her. But he could not ignore the beauty of these personal associates of Krishna in female form. So Krishna is enjoying how these two wings, the leader of the left wing, the right wing, Radharani's leader of the left wing, and they are tugging on either side of Krishna. Come with us. No, come with us. Come with us. So he's enjoying this. But the emotions exchanged between these two wings are very, 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 very heated. You can just imagine. They're smiling at Krishna, please come with us, and then they're looking at the other gopis on the other side, you know, giving them these piercing looks. Get out of here. Go away. So all of that is there in Krishna's pastimes. So don't impose, you know, suburban etiquette. In America, they have this ideal conception of suburbia, you know, outside the big cities. You have all these neighborhoods where every house looks the same, every lawn is trimmed, everyone, you know, every family is a happy family with two or three children. Every wife is beautiful, every husband is dutiful and earning good money, and there's one or two or three shining cars out front, always gleaming with fresh polish, you see, and flowers in the garden, and everyone, hello, being very friendly, you see, it's a conception utopia. It doesn't exist, actually. But the karmis, this is what they aspire for. You know, such a world to live in. But the spiritual world is not like that. The spiritual world is not the ultimate suburban neighborhood. And if that's what you think, then watch out. Or you may end up in your next life. It won't be Goloka Vrindavan, that's for sure. So, yes. Because of rasa, there can be the most heated exchange, the most... even the most... offensive language sometimes. You know, make your cheeks blush. You want to close your ears. Sometimes such words are being spoken between devotees in the spiritual world. Out of love for Krishna. The point is, if it satisfies Krishna, then it is pure. But if it is centered around my satisfaction, then it is impure. So, sometimes, well, whenever great devotee who is transcendentally situated, coming from the spiritual world into this world to preach, he is also preaching from his... The mood of his preaching is actually originating from his identity in the spiritual world. And therefore sometimes such a devotee will, like Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, even his own disciples, because I heard this from Srila Prabhupada, that even some of his own disciples, they used to talk among themselves and raise the question, why is Guru Maharaj speaking so strongly? He has this chopping, Prabhupada used to call it chopping method. Just chop, 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 chop. And even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's own disciples, some of them, some of whom later fell down because of making this offense, they were thinking, why does he have to speak like that? Why can't he be a little more accommodating? Why? And others used to say, other Vaishnava leaders here in Bengal, because he was so powerful, so learned. He was there was no competition. He was the most prominent Vaishnava preacher of his time. So all the others, they even would offer themselves. We want to work with you. You are so powerful. You are able to lead the charge. You are really able to spread Vaishnavism across Bengal and across India and across the world. And we will follow you. But why do you have to be so heavy on us? Because his preaching was, unless you are following exactly these teachings that are coming down, this Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, then you're out. Then you're off. Then you're useless. Asar. You're totally useless. We have no need of you. You see, his position was, if you want to join us, fine. Then give up your nonsense and you become, just like I read that, remember? I read that last purport from Brahma Sanghita. And he's describing the other. This is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur describing the Vishishta Dvaita, Dvaita Dvaita, Shuddha Dvaita, the other, I've forgotten, but there's four Vaishnava positions in the four sampradayas, as simply products of mental speculation, which should be rejected. So he's talking about the philosophies of other tika acharyas, great acharyas like Madhva, Ramanuja, Vishnu Swami, Nimbarka, you see, rejecting them as speculation. Because for Gaudiyas, the actual commentary of Bhagavatam is what? Vedanta Sutra is what? Srimad Bhagavatam. And so therefore we have no need of these attempts to explain Vedanta Sutra. Because Vyasadeva is already given under the instructions of Narada Muni. So he was speaking so strongly Now we know Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he stressed this, Sri Barsha Bonavi Devi Dayataya. So, Sri Barsha Bonavi Devi is who? Srimati Radharani. And Dayata means servant. So, what does that mean? Well, I'll tell you what it means. I will immediately clarify by saying this is what, because His Holiness Bhakti Vikash Maharaj, being very fluent in Bengali language, he is reading the source books themselves, the writings of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. There are many, 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 many books of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur which are not available in English. And he is doing a very intense study of all of them. So, he was speaking to me yesterday about the transcendental identity of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And so, Dayata, servant. So, we are served in this body by our senses. You see, like the hand is a servant of the whole body. Prabhupada gives this example, this very example, finger. If you cut the finger off the body, everyone knows this. This is a standard example Prabhupada often gives. If you cut the finger off the body, then it's useless. You see? So he gives the example of the jiva being separated from Krishna. You see? That way. So Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur is actually the very, you see, let us consider Srimati Radharani. So the most attractive feature of a person, beautiful person, is what? The face. So Radharani is all attractive, but particularly her face, her moon-like beautiful face, is so, so, so attractive, so sweet. We can say her whole total form is nectar, but then the nectar becomes more concentrated in the face. Now in the face, what are the most attractive features of the face? The eyes. So she has beautiful lotus eyes. So even then the eyes, the beauty of the face is becoming more concentrated. And then within the eyes, looking at the eyes themselves, what is the most attractive feature? The pupil. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is actually angsa, or expansion, of the pupil of Srimati Radharani. So just like we say Sudarshan Chakra, the weapon of the Lord. But it also, Prabhupada explains, means the divine glance of the Lord, by which when he glances at the material nature, then the whole wheel of time begins to turn. The Kala Chakra is a form of Sudarshan, you see. And on the other side, the spiritual side, Sudarshan is the Kriya Shakti. Maharaj was speaking the other day about Kriya Shakti as being Abhideya, the process of devotional service. So everything that is happening in the spiritual world is revolving around the hub of the Kriya Shakti. It is the driving force. In Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we speak of Lord Balaram as Kriya Shakti. But Sudarshan is also non-different. Actually, Sudarshan is non-different from Narasimhadev. But the difference is that whereas Lord Nrisimhadev destroys the obstacles of devotional service, then that's why in South India they're worshipped back-to-back. We have upstairs in our temple a back-to-back murti. There's Nrisimhadev on one side, Sudarshan on the other. So Lord Nrisimhadev is destroying all obstacles to bhakti. There's that prayer in Bhagavatam, Om Namo Bhagavate Narasimhaya Namaste Tejas Te Ave Ave Bhava. Vajra Naka Vajradangstra Karmasayan. So with your powerful Naka means nails, which are like Vajra, lightning bolts. And Dangstra means teeth. Please rip out the propensity for karma from my heart. You see? Please just pull it all out, just like you pulled Hiranyakashipu's guts out. Pull all the impurities out of my heart. Protect me. You know, it's a prayer for protection from ourselves. Because our own impurities, they hinder our progress in devotional service. And on the other side, there is Sudarshan, who is the devotee of the Lord. Yet he is non-different from Lord Nrisimhadev. And he is the giver of bhakti. So he has a place. If you go to Manasi Ganga in Vrindavan, please visit the Chakra Tirtha. There's where Sudarshan stays. You find in the 9th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Ambarish Maharaj. Now Ambarish Maharaj, what is his fame? Who can tell me? What is the particular fame, kirti of Ambarish Maharaj?
Yes,
he is expert in all 9 processes of devotional service. So he offers prayers to Sri Sudarshan Chakra. And you read those prayers and you will find in those prayers that he is pointing out how all the Nava Angas of Bhakti are within Sudarshan. And he should know because he is expert at them. Just like Kirtanam. So he addresses Sudarshan as, what is it? Girampati, which means master of speech, master of glorification, Krishna. So all of the 9-fold Angas. So anyway, Sudarshan. The Sudarshan, by the glance of the Lord on his devotees, he is sending them into ecstasy when he glances, just Krishna glances at the gopis and they go into ecstasy and they become inspired to serve him. Therefore you see so many prayers praying for the kataksha, the merciful sidelong glance of the Lord. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or Lord Krishna, please just glance upon me. That is his Sudarshan, because then my bhakti will become enlivened, then that dynamo, you see, that transcendental dynamo within the heart to serve you will start to turn, you see, with greater and greater speed. So actually, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is the very Sudarshan of Srimati Radharani. And so whatever he saw that was not pleasing to Radharani, he immediately cut to shreds. Because that is Radharani. She is so sweet. She is irresistible. But she is so hot. That if you get on her wrong side, it's just like Sudarshan also. He's described in the Shastras as being so beautiful to look at. The hub is always described, and the hub of Sudarshan is always described as so beautiful, so splendorous, because it is a source of the sun. Surya is just a minor expansion of the glory of Sudarshan. You see, so beautiful, so effulgent, so resplendent, and yet on the other side, so powerful, cutting, even. Durvas, who was master of all Asta cities, he was so powerful that he could, by his mystic power, pass through the layers of the universe and enter Vaikuntha. Such power as he—that's so rare. Normally, yogis cannot do that, but he had that power because he's an expansion of Lord Shiva. He had that power to go to Vaikuntha by his own mystic attainments. But he was, why did he go to Vaikuntha? Because he was running headlong in fear of the burning Tejas of Sudarshan. So, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was actually speaking from the vision of Srimati Radharani herself. And that's why it's like this or nothing. Get out! That's Radharani. That is her yuta. She knows, there's nobody who knows how to satisfy Krishna like Radharani. And she is she is the ultimate, what you say, obsessive perfectionist. Everything for Krishna, it must be perfect, and if it's not, get out! She becomes hot, angry. That's her mood. And yet her desire is to offer the sweetest thing to Krishna. So the point is that we as devotees, we have to accommodate ourselves to rasa, not that rasa should accommodate itself to us, our suburban conception of suburban American Sunday school conception of what is nice, you see. Plastic smile. You see? That's not rasa. Rasa is what pleases Krishna. And what pleases Krishna, you know, just like one of Prabhupada's early disciples, the first painter, Prabhupada taught her how to paint. She just had some desire to paint. She wasn't very good. So Prabhupada said, this is how you paint. You pick up the brush, you put it in the paint, you apply it, and you chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. This is how you paint. So she became a great artist. But the first picture she drew of Lord Nrisimhadev killing Hiranyakashipu, Prabhupada came to see. He looked at it and said, why so little blood? And then she said, well, blood isn't so nice, Srila Prabhupada. No, there must be much blood everywhere. Put blood everywhere. Okay, this is rasa. This is what is pleased Lord Nrisimhadev, to splatter the demon's blood all over the walls, to pull his guts out and hang them over his shoulder. How bloody a scene! And Lord Nrisimhadev was just relishing that. Because Prabhupada said he is the incarnation of the anger of God. You see? The anger of God. His anger manifests as Nrisimhadev. That means, just like Prabhupada used to say, they criticize Krishna for being lusty. Yes, he is lusty, Prabhupada said. Yes. But you cannot criticize him. Why? Because he is unlimitedly lusty. You are limitedly lusty. So you cannot compare yourself to Krishna. You cannot point to Krishna and make some judgmental comment about his behavior. Because he is God. He is lusty, yes. Your lust is coming from him. You are imperfect because you don't have as much lust as he does. That's your imperfection. And similarly, anger. It's not that, oh, anger, oh, we don't want to be angry. We want to be... It's not... This is mundane Sunday school... I always say, bourgeois Sunday school conception of spiritual life. You know, where the patient teacher is up in front of little children. Now, Jesus said, we shouldn't be angry.
Yes, teacher.
No, in rasa, Lord Nrisimhadev is, you see, the ultimate hydrogen bomb of anger. Unlimited megatons of angry power burning everything. So the fault of anger is that our anger is limited and imperfect. His is unlimited and therefore perfect. This is the rasa tattva. So don't try to drag Krishna down on your platform. You see, where all these different emotions are arranged in some dualistic fashion. There's anger versus niceness, and we should try to be nice, not angry, blah, 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 blah. Of course, it's sadhana bhakti platform. Now, if I keep talking like this, you'll think I'm crazy. At sadhana bhakti platform, madhyam, there is an etiquette, and we have to follow that, yes. Because we are not on the rasa platform. That is a fact. Therefore, we have an etiquette, Vaishnava etiquette. And that is essential at our platform. But we should not presume that this is the thing, that Lord Nityananda, for example, Lord Nityananda and Advaita Charya, they had famous quarrels. Advaitacharya, Lord Nityananda had such quarrels. They were screaming at one another, shouting at one another. Lord Nityananda was... Prabhupada kind of describes it in the Bhagavatam in a sort of gentle manner, that Lord Nityananda was throwing some rice on Advaitacharya, and Advaitacharya was dancing with a few. It seems the way it's described there, there were some grains of rice stuck to him. But actually, he threw the whole plate, the whole big plate, just threw it at him. I don't want your rice! You're a smart Brahmana! And Lord Advaita Bhattacharya began to dance in ecstasy. He was dancing in ecstasy, but at the same time he was saying, "You bogus sannyasi, you come in my house, you throw food all over, make a big mess. Get out of here, you're such a rascal. You're one of these tantric sannyasis. You're ruining my whole reputation as a brahmana." See, in this way they used to argue back and forth. And it said the devotees present, they would simply remain silent. even in their minds, it would not take a side. Because this was just rasa exploding in front of them. So if we have this conception of the spiritual world as being some kind of suburban American neighborhood, you know, nice white church on the corner, mothers pushing their babies in prams, and, "Good morning." That's someplace else. That's some other destination. That's Goloka Vrindavan. Yes, but on Madhyamadikari platform, preaching for the mission of Krishna consciousness, there is an etiquette. We must follow that. But advanced devotees, they may not adhere to the etiquette. Just like Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He spoke from the vision of Radharani, what is right and what is wrong, the highest vision. So he didn't care about other sampradayas, he didn't care about... Even Prabhupada wrote in the letter, yes, the Shuddha-Dvaita philosophy is bona fide. He wrote that to one devotee who inquired. Yes, it is bona fide philosophy. But Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati would reject it. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was also, his mood was more accommodating. This has to do with the nature of times, the nature of the mission. The mission, again, kutila, it moves like a snake according to the needs. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, in him we see the absolute uncompromising vision of Radharani. So he would not even compromise with other bona fide sampradayas, other bona fide philosophies. All right, so we're over time now. And again, I talked the whole hour. But that was the last question, I hope. So tomorrow, then, hopefully Marj will be here. And we can finish up the 11th chapter. If there's anything that needs to be discussed, we'll finish up. We'll finish up the outline. And then, as mentioned already, the weekend, is it sunset, Sunday or Monday? You're going, Saturday, yeah, Saturday, the Gurukul students and Maharaj and Bagish and Prithivardhan are going to Ujjain to do a Didi installation. So on Monday, only I will be sitting here, and we will, until the day before Nityananda Trayodasi, which I believe is Thursday. Is it Thursday or Friday?
Friday,
okay. So then Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, we will discuss chapter 12. And falling at the feet of our secretary, my differently addressed as Kashi Ram, Kashishwara, Kashi Mishra, Kashi Raj. He has different forms. And sometimes just as Kashi. But his proper name is Kashishwara. So, we hope that Thursday we'll be able to give you an interesting graph of the first canto, a graphic display where you'll be able to see the questions and answers where they fall. Because after all, that is the focus of this class, questions and answers. So we've got a summary graph of the whole first canto so that as far as we've gone, you'll be able to see back and you'll be able to also see ahead. So for your studies when we resume, if you particularly look at the questions and answers on the graph, you'll be well prepared when this class resumes in March. And don't forget also, we will be starting, I think, on the 14th, the Tuesday of the week following this coming week, we'll begin it. Be beginning in the evening. We'll announce it next week, Thursday latest. We'll tell you at what time then the Psychology of Srimad Bhagavatam course will be held according to some schedule at a certain time, certain days, as much as possible. We have 3 weeks, we have a lot of material to cover. It will be very tattvic, very philosophical. But we hope you'll find it very interesting at the same time, because it will explain, we think you'll be able to much better understand the most difficult parts of the Bhagavatam as a result of attending this class, because we're going to go into those very difficult parts very deeply and try to make them clear to you, because they all pertain to psychology ultimately, the makeup of our mind, intelligence, false ego, nature. So thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Guru Premanandi, Hari Hari.